Disc 25.
Chapter 79. When Rosamond was quiet and Lydgate had left her, hoping that she might soon sleep under the effect of an anodyne, he went into the drawing-room to fetch a book which he had left there, meaning to spend the evening in his workroom, and he saw on the table Dorothea's letter addressed to him. He had not ventured to ask Rosamond if Mrs. Casaubon had called, but the reading of this letter assured him of the fact, for Dorothea mentioned that it was to be carried by herself. When Will Ladislaw came in a little later, Lydgate met him with a surprise which made it clear that he had not been told of the earlier visit, and Will could not say, "Did not Mrs. Lydgate tell you that I came this morning?" "Poor Rosamond is ill," Lydgate added immediately on his greeting. "Not seriously, I hope," said Will.
"No, only a slight nervous shock, the effect of some agitation. She has been overwrought lately. The truth is, Ladislaw, I am an unlucky devil. We have gone through several rounds of purgatory since you left, and I have lately got onto a worse ledge of it than ever. I suppose you are only just come down. You look rather battered. You have not been long enough in the town to hear anything."
"I travelled all night and got to the White Hart at 8 o'clock this morning. I have been shutting myself up and resting," said Will, feeling himself a sneak, but seeing no alternative to this evasion. And then he heard Lydgate's account of the troubles which Rosamond had already depicted to him in her way. She had not mentioned the fact of Will's name being connected with the public story, this detail not immediately affecting her, and he now heard it for the first time.
"I thought it better to tell you that your name is mixed up with the disclosures," said Lydgate, who could understand better than most men how Ladislaw might be stung by the revelation. "You will be sure to hear it as soon as you turn out into the town. I suppose it is true that Raffles spoke to you?"
"Yes," said Will sardonically. "I shall be fortunate if gossip does not make me the most disreputable person in the whole affair. I should think the latest version must be that I plotted with Raffles to murder Bulstrode and ran away from Middlemarch for the purpose." He was thinking, "Here is a new ring in the sound of my name to recommend it in her hearing. However, what does it signify now?" But he said nothing of Bulstrode's offer to him. Will was very open and careless about his personal affairs, but it was among the more exquisite touches in nature's modelling of him that he had a delicate generosity which warned him into reticence here. He shrank from saying that he had rejected Bulstrode's money in the moment when he was learning that it was Lydgate's misfortune to have accepted it. Lydgate, too, was reticent in the midst of his confidence. He made no allusion to Rosamond's feeling under their trouble, and of Dorothea he only said, "Mrs. Casaubon has been the one person to come forward and say that she had no belief in any of the suspicions against me." Observing a change in Will's face, he avoided any further mention of her, feeling himself too ignorant of their relation to each other not to fear that his words might have some hidden painful bearing on it. And it occurred to him that Dorothea was the real cause of the present visit to Middlemarch. The two men were pitying each other, but it was only Will who guessed the extent of his companion's trouble. When Lydgate spoke with desperate resignation of going to settle in London, and said with a faint smile, "We shall have you again, old fellow," Will felt inexpressibly mournful, and said nothing. Rosamond had that morning entreated him to urge this step on Lydgate, and it seemed to him as if he were beholding in a magic panorama a future where he himself was sliding into that pleasureless yielding to the small solicitations of circumstance, which is a commoner history of perdition than any single momentous bargain. We are on a perilous margin when we begin to look passively at our future selves, and see our own figures led with dull consent into insipid misdoing and shabby achievement. Poor Lydgate was inwardly groaning on that margin, and Will was arriving at it. It seemed to him this evening as if the cruelty of his outburst to Rosamond had made an obligation for him, and he dreaded the obligation. He dreaded Lydgate's unsuspecting goodwill. He dreaded his own distaste for his spoiled life, which would leave him in motiveless levity.
Chapter 80.
When Dorothea had seen Mr. Fairbrother in the morning, she had promised to go and dine at the parsonage on her return from Freshet. There was a frequent interchange of visits between her and the Fairbrother family, which enabled her to say that she was not at all lonely at the manor, and to resist for the present the severe prescription of a lady companion. When she reached home and remembered her engagement, she was glad of it, and finding that she had still an hour before she could dress for dinner, she walked straight to the schoolhouse and entered into a conversation with the master and mistress about the new bell, giving eager attention to their small details and repetitions, and getting up a dramatic sense that her life was very busy. She paused on her way back to talk to old Master Bunny, who was putting in some garden seeds, and discoursed wisely with that rural sage about the crops that would make the most return on a perch of ground, and the result of 60 years' experience as to soils, namely, that if your soil was pretty mellow, it would do, but if there came wet, 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 to make it all of a mummy, why then? Finding that the social spirit had beguiled her into being rather late, she dressed hastily and went over to the parsonage rather earlier than was necessary. That house was never dull. Mr. Fairbrother, like another White of Selborne, having continually something new to tell of his inarticulate guests and protégés whom he was teaching the boys not to torment, and he had just set up a pair of beautiful goats to be pets of the village in general and to walk at large as sacred animals. The evening went by cheerfully till after tea, Dorothea talking more than usual and dilating with Mr. Fairbrother on the possible histories of creatures that converse compendiously with their antennae and, for aught we know, may hold reformed parliaments, when suddenly some inarticulate little sounds were heard which called everybody's attention.
"Henrietta Noble,"
said Mrs. Fairbrother, seeing her small sister moving about the furniture legs distressfully,
"what is the matter?"
"I have lost my tortoiseshell lozenge box. I fear the kitten has rolled it away,"
said the tiny old lady, involuntarily continuing her beaver-like notes.
"Is it a great treasure, aunt?" said Mr. Fairbrother, putting up his glasses and looking at the carpet.
"Mr. Ladislaw gave it me,"
said Miss Noble.
"A German box, very pretty. But if it falls, it always spins away as far as it can."
"Oh, if it is Ladislaw's present," said Mr. Fairbrother, in a deep tone of comprehension, getting up and hunting. The box was found at last under a chiffonier, and Miss Noble grasped it with delight, saying,
"It was under a fender the last time."
"That is an affair of the heart with my aunt," said Mr. Fairbrother, smiling at Dorothea as he reseated himself.
"If Henrietta Noble forms an attachment to anyone, Mrs. Casaubon," said his mother emphatically, "she is like a dog. She would take their shoes for a pillow and sleep the better."
"Mr. Ladislaw's shoes I would," said Henrietta Noble.
Dorothea made an attempt at smiling in return. She was surprised and annoyed to find that her heart was palpitating violently, and that it was quite useless to try after a recovery of her former animation. Alarmed at herself, fearing some further betrayal of a change so marked in its occasion, she rose and said in a low voice with undisguised anxiety,
"I must go. I have overtired myself."
Mr. Fairbrother, quick in perception, rose and said,
"It is true. You must have half exhausted yourself in talking about Lydgate. That sort of work tells upon one after the excitement is over."
He gave her his arm back to the manor, but Dorothea did not attempt to speak, even when he said good night. The limit of resistance was reached, and she had sunk back helpless within the clutch of inescapable anguish. Dismissing Tantripp with a few faint words, she locked her door, and turning away from it towards the vacant room, she pressed her hands hard on the top of her head and moaned out,
"Oh, I did love him."
Then came the hour in which the waves of suffering shook her too thoroughly to leave any power of thought. She could only cry in loud whispers between her sobs. After her lost belief, which she had planted and kept alive from a very little seed since the days in Rome, after her lost joy of clinging with silent love and faith to one who, misprized by others, was worthy in her thought, after her lost woman's pride of reigning in his memory, after her sweet, dim perspective of hope that along some pathway they should meet with unchanged recognition and take up the backward years as a yesterday. In that hour she repeated what the merciful eyes of solitude have looked on for ages in the spiritual struggles of man. She besought hardness and coldness and aching weariness to bring her relief from the mysterious incorporeal might of her anguish. She lay on the bare floor and let the night grow cold around her, while her grand woman's frame was shaken by sobs as if she had been a despairing child. There were two images, two living forms that tore her heart in two, as if it had been the heart of a mother who seems to see her child divided by the sword and presses one bleeding half to her breast, while her gaze goes forth in agony towards the half which is carried away by the lying woman that has never known the mother's pang. Here, with the nearness of an answering smile, here within the vibrating bond of mutual speech, was the bright creature whom she had trusted, who had come to her like the spirit of mourning, visiting the dim vault where she sat as the bride of a worn-out life. And now, with a full consciousness which had never awakened before, she stretched out her arms towards him and cried with bitter cries that their nearness was a parting vision. She discovered her passion to herself in the unshrinking utterance of despair. And there, aloof yet persistently with her, moving wherever she moved, was the Will Ladislaw who was a changed belief, exhausted of hope, a detected illusion. No, a living man towards whom there could not yet struggle any wail of regretful pity from the midst of scorn and indignation and jealous offended pride. The fire of Dorothea's anger was not easily spent, and it flamed out in fitful returns of spurning reproach. Why had he come obtruding his life into hers, hers that might have been whole enough without him? Why had he brought his cheap regard and his lip-borne words to her who had nothing paltry to give in exchange? He knew that he was deluding her, wished in the very moment of farewell to make her believe that he gave her the whole price of her heart, and knew that he had spent it half before. Why had he not stayed among the crowd, of whom she asked nothing, but only prayed that they might be less contemptible? But she lost energy at last, even for her loud-whispered cries and moans. She subsided into helpless sobs, and on the cold floor she sobbed herself to sleep. In the chill hours of the morning twilight, when all was dim around her, she awoke, not with any amazed wondering where she was or what had happened, but with the clearest consciousness that she was looking into the eyes of sorrow. She rose and wrapped warm things around her and seated herself in a great chair where she had often watched before. She was vigorous enough to have borne that hard night without feeling ill in body, beyond some aching and fatigue, but she had waked to a new condition. She felt as if her soul had been liberated from its terrible conflict. She was no longer wrestling with her grief, but could sit down with it as a lasting companion and make it a sharer in her thoughts. For now the thoughts came thickly. It was not in Dorothea's nature, for longer than the duration of a paroxysm, to sit in the narrow cell of her calamity, in the besotted misery of a consciousness that only sees another's lot as an accident of its own. She began now to live through that yesterday morning deliberately again, forcing herself to dwell on every detail and its possible meaning. Was she alone in that scene? Was it her event only? She forced herself to think of it as bound up with another woman's life, a woman towards whom she had set out with a longing to carry some clearness and comfort into her beclouded youth. In her first outleap of jealous indignation and disgust when quitting the hateful room, she had flung away all the mercy with which she had undertaken that visit. She had enveloped both Will and Rosamond in her burning scorn, and it seemed to her as if Rosamond were burned out of her sight forever. But that base prompting which makes a woman more cruel to a rival than to a faithless lover could have no strength of recurrence in Dorothea, when the dominant spirit of justice within her had once overcome the tumult, and had once shown her the truer measure of things. All the active thought with which she had before been representing to herself the trials of Lydgate's lot, and this young married union which, like her own,
seemed to have its hidden as well as evident troubles. All this vivid, sympathetic experience returned to her now as a power. It asserted itself as acquired knowledge asserts itself, and will not let us see as we saw in the day of our ignorance. She said to her own irremediable grief that it should make her more helpful instead of driving her back from effort. And what sort of crisis might not this be, in three lives whose contact with hers laid an obligation on her, as if they had been suppliants bearing the sacred branch? The objects of her rescue were not to be sought out by her fancy. They were chosen for her. She yearned towards the perfect right, that it might make a throne within her and rule her errant will. What should I do? How should I act now, this very day, if I could clutch my own pain and compel it to silence and think of those three? It had taken long for her to come to that question, and there was light piercing into the room. She opened her curtains and looked out towards the bit of road that lay in view, with fields beyond, outside the entrance gates. On the road there was a man with a bundle on his back, and a woman carrying her baby. In the field she could see figures moving, perhaps the shepherd with his dog. Far off in the bending sky was the pearly light, and she felt the largeness of the world and the manifold wakings of men to labour and endurance. She was a part of that involuntary palpitating life, and could neither look out on it from her luxurious shelter as a mere spectator, nor hide her eyes in selfish complaining. What she would resolve to do that day did not yet seem quite clear, but something that she could achieve stirred her as with an approaching murmur which would soon gather distinctness. She took off the clothes, which seemed to have some of the weariness of a hard watching in them, and began to make her toilet. Presently she rang for Tantripp, who came in her dressing gown.
"Why, madam, you've never been in bed this blessed night,"
burst out Tantripp, looking first at the bed and then at Dorothea's face, which, in spite of bathing, had the pale cheeks and pink eyelids of a Mater Dolorosa.
"You'll kill yourself, you will. Anybody might think now you had a right to give yourself a little comfort."
"Don't be alarmed, Tantripp," said Dorothea, smiling. "I have slept. I am not ill. I shall be glad of a cup of coffee as soon as possible. And I want you to bring me my new dress. And most likely I shall want my new bonnet today."
"They've lain there a month and more ready for you, madam, and most thankful I shall be to see you with a couple of pounds worth less of cripe," said Tantripp, stooping to light the fire.
"There's a reason in mourning, as I've always said, and three folds at the bottom of your skirt and a plain quilling in your bonnet, and if ever anybody looked like an angel, it's you in a net quilling, is what's consistent for a second year. At least that's my thinking," ended Tantripp, looking anxiously at the fire. "And if anybody was to marry me, flattering himself I should wear those hideous weepers 2 years for him, he'd be deceived by his own vanity, that's all."
"The fire will do, my good Tan," said Dorothea,
speaking as she used to do in the old Lausanne days, only with a very low voice.
"Get me the coffee."
She folded herself in the large chair and leaned her head against it in fatigued quiescence, while Tantripp went away wondering at this strange contrariness in her young mistress, that just the morning when she had more of a widow's face than ever, she should have asked for her lighter mourning, which she had waived before. Tantripp would never have found the clue to this mystery. Dorothea wished to acknowledge that she had not the less an active life before her, because she had buried a private joy. And the tradition that fresh garments belonged to all initiation haunting her mind made her grasp after even that slight outward help towards calm resolve, for the resolve was not easy. Nevertheless, at 11 o'clock she was walking towards Middlemarch, having made up her mind that she would make as quietly and unnoticeably as possible her second attempt to see and save Rosamond. Chapter 81.
When Dorothea was again at Lydgate's door speaking to Martha, he was in the room close by with the door ajar, preparing to go out. He heard her voice and immediately came to her. "Do you think that Mrs. Lydgate can receive me this morning?" she said, having reflected that it would be better to leave out all allusion to her previous visit.
"I have no doubt she will," said Lydgate, suppressing his thought about Dorothea's looks, which were as much changed as Rosamond's. "If you will be kind enough to come in and let me tell her that you are here. She has not been very well since you were here yesterday, but she is better this morning, and I think it is very likely that she will be cheered by seeing you again."
It was plain that Lydgate, as Dorothea had expected, knew nothing about the circumstances of her yesterday's visit. Nay, he appeared to imagine that she had carried it out according to her intention. She had prepared a little note asking Rosamond to see her, which she would have given to the servant if he had not been in the way. But now she was in much anxiety as to the result of his announcement. After leading her into the drawing room, he paused to take a letter from his pocket and put it into her hand, saying, "I wrote this last night and was going to carry it to Lowick in my ride. When one is grateful for something too good for common thanks, writing is less unsatisfactory than speech. One does not at least hear how inadequate the words are."
Dorothea's face brightened. "It is I who have most to thank for, since you have let me take that place. You have consented," she said, suddenly doubting.
"Yes, the cheque is going to Bulstrode today."
He said no more, but went upstairs to Rosamond, who had but lately finished dressing herself, and sat languidly wondering what she should do next. Her habitual industry in small things, even in the days of her sadness, prompting her to begin some kind of occupation, which she dragged through slowly or paused in from lack of interest. She looked ill, but had recovered her usual quietude of manner, and Lydgate had feared to disturb her by any questions. He had told her of Dorothea's letter containing the cheque, and afterwards he had said,
"Ladislaw is come, Rosie. He sat with me last night. I dare say he will be here again today. I thought he looked rather battered and depressed."
And Rosamond had made no reply. Now, when he came up, he said to her very gently, "Rosie, dear, Mrs. Casaubon is come to see you again. You would like to see her, would you not?" That she coloured and gave rather a startled movement did not surprise him after the agitation produced by the interview yesterday. A beneficent agitation, he thought, since it seemed to have made her turn to him again. Rosamond dared not say no. She dared not, with a tone of her voice, touch the facts of yesterday. Why had Mrs. Casaubon come again? The answer was a blank, which Rosamond could only fill up with dread, for Will Ladislaw's lacerating words had made every thought of Dorothea a fresh smart to her. Nevertheless, in her new humiliating uncertainty, she dared do nothing but comply. She did not say yes, but she rose and let Lydgate put a light shawl over her shoulders, while he said, "I am going out immediately." Then something crossed her mind which prompted her to say,
"Pray tell Martha not to bring anyone else into the drawing-room."
And Lydgate assented, thinking that he fully understood this wish. He led her down to the drawing-room door and then turned away, observing to himself that he was rather a blundering husband to be dependent for his wife's trust in him on the influence of another woman. Rosamond, wrapping her soft shawl around her as she walked towards Dorothea, was inwardly wrapping her soul in cold reserve. Had Mrs. Casaubon come to say anything to her about Will? If so, it was a liberty that Rosamond resented, and she prepared herself to meet every word with polite impassibility. Will had bruised her pride too sorely for her to feel any compunction towards him and Dorothea. Her own injury seemed much the greater. Dorothea was not only the preferred woman, but had also a formidable advantage in being Lydgate's benefactor, and to poor Rosamond's pained, confused vision, it seemed that this Mrs. Casaubon, this woman who predominated in all things concerning her, must have come now with the sense of having the advantage, and with animosity prompting her to use it. Indeed, not Rosamond only, but anyone else knowing the outer facts of the case, and not the simple inspiration on which Dorothea acted, might well have wondered why she came. Looking like the lovely ghost of herself, her graceful slimness wrapped in her soft white shawl,
the rounded infantine mouth and cheek inevitably suggesting mildness and innocence. Rosamond paused at 3 yards' distance from her visitor and bowed. But Dorothea, who had taken off her gloves from an impulse which she could never resist when she wanted a sense of freedom, came forward, and with her face full of a sad yet sweet openness, put out her hand. Rosamond could not avoid meeting her glance, could not avoid putting her small hand into Dorothea's, which clasped it with gentle motherliness. And immediately a doubt of her own prepossessions began to stir within her. Rosamond's eye was quick for faces. She saw that Mrs. Casaubon's face looked pale and changed since yesterday, yet gentle, and like the firm softness of her hand. But Dorothea had counted a little too much on her own strength. The clearness and intensity of her mental action this morning were the continuance of a nervous exaltation which made her frame as dangerously responsive as a bit of finest Venetian crystal. And in looking at Rosamond, she suddenly found her heart swelling and was unable to speak. All her effort was required to keep back tears. She succeeded in that, and the emotion only passed over her face like the spirit of a sob. But it added to Rosamond's impression that Mrs. Casaubon's state of mind must be something quite different from what she had imagined. So they sat down without a word of preface on the 2 chairs that happened to be nearest and happened also to be close together, though Rosamond's notion when she first bowed was that she should stay a long way off from Mrs. Casaubon. But she ceased thinking how anything would turn out, merely wondering what would come. And Dorothea began to speak quite simply, gathering firmness as she went on. "I had an errand yesterday which I did not finish. That is why I am here again so soon. You will not think me too troublesome when I tell you that I came to talk to you about the injustice that has been shown towards Mr. Lydgate. It will cheer you, will it not, to know a great deal about him, that he may not like to speak about himself, just because it is in his own vindication and to his own honour. You will like to know that your husband has warm friends who have not left off believing in his high character. You will let me speak of this without thinking that I take a liberty." The cordial, pleading tones, which seemed to flow with generous heedlessness above all the facts which had filled Rosamond's mind as grounds of obstruction and hatred between her and this woman, came as soothingly as a warm stream over her shrinking fears. Of course, Mrs. Casaubon had the facts in her mind, but she was not going to speak of anything connected with them. That relief was too great for Rosamond to feel much else at the moment. She answered prettily, in the new ease of her soul,
"I know you have been very good. I shall like to hear anything you will say to me about Tertius."
"The day before yesterday," said Dorothea, "when I had asked him to come to Lowick to give me his opinion on the affairs of the hospital, he told me everything about his conduct and feelings in this sad event which has made ignorant people cast suspicions on him. The reason, he told me, was because I was very bold and asked him. I believed that he had never acted dishonourably, and I begged him to tell me the history. He confessed to me that he had never told it before, not even to you, because he had a great dislike to say, 'I was not wrong,' as if that were proof, when there are guilty people who will say so. The truth is, he knew nothing of this man Raffles, or that there were any bad secrets about him, and he thought that Mr. Bulstrode offered him the money because he repented, out of kindness, of having refused it before. All his anxiety about his patient was to treat him rightly, and he was a little uncomfortable that the case did not end as he had expected, but he thought then, and still thinks, that there may have been no wrong in it on anyone's part. And I have told Mr. Fairbrother, and Mr. Brooke, and Sir James Chettam. They all believe in your husband. That will cheer you, will it not? That will give you courage." Dorothea's face had become animated, and as it beamed on Rosamond very close to her, she felt something like bashful timidity before a superior in the presence of this self-forgetful ardour. She said, with blushing embarrassment,
"Thank you. You are very kind."
And he felt that he had been so wrong not to pour out everything about this to you. But you will forgive him. It was because he feels so much more about your happiness than anything else. He feels his life bound into one with yours, and it hurts him more than anything that his misfortunes must hurt you. He could speak to me because I am an indifferent person. And then I asked him if I might come to see you, because I felt so much for his trouble and yours. That is why I came yesterday, and why I am come today. Trouble is so hard to bear, is it not? How can we live and think that anyone has trouble, piercing trouble, and we could help them and never try?
Dorothea, completely swayed by the feeling that she was uttering, forgot everything but that she was speaking from out the heart of her own trial to Rosamond's. The emotion had wrought itself more and more into her utterance, till the tones might have gone to one's very marrow, like a low cry from some suffering creature in the darkness. And she had unconsciously laid her hand again on the little hand that she had pressed before.
Rosamond, with an overmastering pang, as if a wound within her had been probed, burst into hysterical crying, as she had done the day before when she clung to her husband.
Poor Dorothea was feeling a great wave of her own sorrow returning over her, her thought being drawn to the possible share that Will Ladislaw might have in Rosamond's mental tumult. She was beginning to fear that she should not be able to suppress herself enough to the end of this meeting, and while her hand was still resting on Rosamond's lap, though the hand underneath it was withdrawn, she was struggling against her own rising sobs. She tried to master herself with the thought that this might be a turning point in three lives. Not in her own, no. There the irrevocable had happened. But in those three lives which were touching hers with the solemn neighbourhood of danger and distress. The fragile creature who was crying close to her. There might still be time to rescue her from the misery of false incompatible bonds. And this moment was unlike any other. She and Rosamond could never be together again with the same thrilling consciousness of yesterday within them both. She felt the relation between them to be peculiar enough to give her a peculiar influence, though she had no conception that the way in which her own feelings were involved was fully known to Mrs. Lydgate. It was a newer crisis in Rosamond's experience than even Dorothea could imagine. She was under the first great shock that had shattered her dream world, in which she had been easily confident of herself and critical of others. And this strange, unexpected manifestation of feeling, in a woman whom she had approached with a shrinking aversion and dread, as one who must necessarily have a jealous hatred towards her, made her soul totter all the more, with a sense that she had been walking in an unknown world which had just broken in upon her. When Rosamond's convulsed throat was subsiding into calm, and she withdrew the handkerchief with which she had been hiding her face, her eyes met Dorothea's as helplessly as if they had been blue flowers. What was the use of thinking about behaviour after this crying? And Dorothea looked almost as childish, with the neglected trace of a silent tear. Pride was broken down between these two.
"We were talking about your husband," Dorothea said, with some timidity. "I thought his looks were sadly changed with suffering the other day. I had not seen him for many weeks before. He said he had been feeling very lonely in his trial. But I think he would have borne it all better if he had been able to be quite open with you."
"Tertius is so angry and impatient if I say anything,"
said Rosamond, imagining that he had been complaining of her to Dorothea.
"He ought not to wonder that I object to speak to him on painful subjects."
"It was himself he blamed for not speaking," said Dorothea. "What he said of you was that he could not be happy in doing anything which made you unhappy, that his marriage was, of course, a bond which must affect his choice about everything. And for that reason he refused my proposal that he should keep his position at the hospital, because that would bind him to stay in Middlemarch, and he would not undertake to do anything which would be painful to you. He could say that to me, because he knows that I had much trial in my marriage from my husband's illness, which hindered his plans and saddened him, and he knows that I have felt how hard it is to walk always in fear of hurting another who is tied to us."
Dorothea waited a little. She had discerned a faint pleasure stealing over Rosamond's face.
But there was no answer, and she went on with a gathering tremor.
"Marriage is so unlike everything else. There is something even awful in the nearness it brings. Even if we loved someone else better than those we were married to, it would be no use."
Poor Dorothea, in her palpitating anxiety, could only seize her language brokenly.
"I mean, marriage drinks up all our power of giving or getting any blessedness in that sort of love. I know it may be very dear, but it murders our marriage. And then the marriage stays with us like a murder, and everything else is gone. And then our husband, if he loved and trusted us, and we have not helped him but made a curse in his life."
Her voice had sunk very low. There was a dread upon her of presuming too far, and of speaking as if she herself were perfection addressing error. She was too much preoccupied with her own anxiety to be aware that Rosamond was trembling too, and filled with the need to express pitying fellowship rather than rebuke, she put her hands on Rosamond's, and said with more agitated rapidity,
I know that the feeling may be very dear. It has taken hold of us unawares. It is so hard. It may seem like death to part with it. And we are weak. I am weak."
The waves of her own sorrow, from out of which she was struggling to save another, rushed over Dorothea with conquering force. She stopped in speechless agitation, not crying, but feeling as if she were being inwardly grappled. Her face had become of a deathlier paleness, her lips trembled, and she pressed her hands helplessly on the hands that lay under them. Rosamond, taken hold of by an emotion stronger than her own, hurried along in a new movement which gave all things some new, awful, undefined aspect, could find no words. But involuntarily she put her lips to Dorothea's forehead, which was very near her. And then for a minute the two women clasped each other as if they had been in a shipwreck.
"You are thinking what is not true," said Rosamond, in an eager half-whisper, while she was still feeling Dorothea's arms round her,
urged by a mysterious necessity to free herself from something that oppressed her as if it were blood guiltiness. They moved apart, looking at each other.
"When you came in yesterday, it was not as you thought," said Rosamond, in the same tone.
There was a movement of surprised attention in Dorothea. She expected a vindication of Rosamond herself.
"He was telling me how he loved another woman, that I might know he could never love me," said Rosamond,
getting more and more hurried as she went on.
"And now I think he hates me because you mistook him yesterday. He says it is through me that you will think ill of him, think that he is a false person. But it shall not be through me. He has never had any love for me. I know he has not. He has always thought slightly of me. He said yesterday that no other woman existed for him besides you. The blame of what happened is entirely mine. He said he could never explain to you because of me. He said you could never think well of him again. But now I have told you, and he cannot reproach me any more."
Rosamond had delivered her soul under impulses which she had not known before. She had begun her confession under the subduing influence of Dorothea's emotion, and as she went on, she had gathered the sense that she was repelling Will's reproaches, which were still like a knife wound within her. The revulsion of feeling in Dorothea was too strong to be called joy. It was a tumult, in which the terrible strain of the night and morning made a resistant pain. She could only perceive that this would be joy when she had recovered her power of feeling it. Her immediate consciousness was one of immense sympathy without check. She cared for Rosamond without struggle now, and responded earnestly to her last words.
"No, he cannot reproach you any more."
With her usual tendency to overestimate the good in others, she felt a great outgoing of her heart towards Rosamond, for the generous effort which had redeemed her from suffering, not counting that the effort was a reflex of her own energy. After they had been silent a little, she said,
"You are not sorry that I came this morning?"
"No, you have been very good to me," said Rosamond. I did not think that you would be so good. I was very unhappy. I am not happy now. Everything is so sad.
But better days will come. Your husband will be rightly valued. And he depends on you for comfort. He loves you best. The worst loss would be to lose that. And you have not lost it, said Dorothea.
She tried to thrust away the too overpowering thought of her own relief, lest she should fail to win some sign that Rosamond's affection was yearning back towards her husband.
Tertius did not find fault with me then, said Rosamond,
understanding now that Lydgate might have said anything to Mrs. Casaubon, and that she certainly was different from other women. Perhaps there was a faint taste of jealousy in the question. A smile began to play over Dorothea's face as she said,
No, indeed. How could you imagine it?
But here the door opened, and Lydgate entered. I am come back in my quality of doctor, he said. After I went away, I was haunted by two pale faces. Mrs. Casaubon looked as much in need of care as you, Rosie, and I thought that I had not done my duty in leaving you together. So when I had been to Coleman's, I came home again. I noticed that you were walking, Mrs. Casaubon, and the sky has changed. I think we may have rain. May I send someone to order your carriage to come for you?
Oh, no, I am strong. I need the walk, said Dorothea,
rising with animation in her face.
Mrs. Lydgate and I have chatted a great deal, and it is time for me to go. I have always been accused of being immoderate and saying too much.
She put out her hand to Rosamond, and they said an earnest, quiet goodbye without kiss or other show of effusion. There had been between them too much serious emotion for them to use the signs of it superficially. As Lydgate took her to the door, she said nothing of Rosamond, but told him of Mr. Fairbrother and the other friends who had listened with belief to his story. When he came back to Rosamond, she had already thrown herself on the sofa in resigned fatigue. "Well, Rosie," he said, standing over her and touching her hair. "What do you think of Mrs. Casaubon, now you have seen so much of her?"
"I think she must be better than anyone," said Rosamond. "And she is very beautiful. If you go to talk to her so often, you will be more discontented with me than ever."
Lydgate laughed at the "so often." "But has she made you any less discontented with me?"
"I think she has," said Rosamond, looking up in his face. "How heavy your eyes are, Tertius, and do push your hair back."
He lifted up his large white hand to obey her, and felt thankful for this little mark of interest in him. Poor Rosamond's vagrant fancy had come back terribly scourged, meek enough to nestle under the old despised shelter. And the shelter was still there. Lydgate had accepted his narrowed lot with sad resignation. He had chosen this fragile creature, and had taken the burthen of her life upon his arms. He must walk as he could, carrying that burthen pitifully. Chapter 82. Exiles notoriously feed much on hopes, and are unlikely to stay in banishment unless they are obliged. When Will Ladislaw exiled himself from Middlemarch, he had placed no stronger obstacle to his return than his own resolve, which was by no means an iron barrier, but simply a state of mind liable to melt into a minuet with other states of mind, and to find itself bowing, smiling, and giving place with polite facility. As the months went on, it had seemed more and more difficult to him to say why he should not run down to Middlemarch, merely for the sake of hearing something about Dorothea. And if on such a flying visit he should chance by some strange coincidence to meet with her, there was no reason for him to be ashamed of having taken an innocent journey which he had beforehand supposed that he should not take. Since he was hopelessly divided from her, he might surely venture into her neighbourhood. And as to the suspicious friends who kept a dragon watch over her, their opinions seemed less and less important with time and change of air. And there had come a reason quite irrespective of Dorothea
which seemed to make a journey to Middlemarch a sort of philanthropic duty. Will had given a disinterested attention to an intended settlement on a new plan in the far west, and the need for funds in order to carry out a good design had set him on debating with himself whether it would not be a laudable use to make of his claim on Bulstrode, to urge the application of that money which had been offered to himself, as a means of carrying out a scheme likely to be largely beneficial. The question seemed a very dubious one to Will, and his repugnance to again entering into any relation with the banker might have made him dismiss it quickly, if there had not arisen in his imagination the probability that his judgment might be more safely determined by a visit to Middlemarch. That was the object which Will stated to himself as a reason for coming down. He had meant to confide in Lydgate and discuss the money question with him, and he had meant to amuse himself for the few evenings of his stay by having a great deal of music and badinage with fair Rosamond, without neglecting his friends at Lowick Parsonage. If the parsonage was close to the manor, that was no fault of his. He had neglected the Fairbrothers before his departure from a proud resistance to the possible accusation of indirectly seeking interviews with Dorothea. But hunger tames us, and Will had become very hungry for the vision of a certain form and the sound of a certain voice. Nothing had done instead. Not the opera, or the converse of zealous politicians, or the flattering reception in dim corners of his new hand in leading articles. Thus he had come down, foreseeing with confidence how almost everything would be in his familiar little world, fearing indeed that there would be no surprises in his visit. But he had found that humdrum world in a terribly dynamic condition, in which even badinage and lyrism had turned explosive, and the first day of this visit had become the most fatal epoch of his life. The next morning he felt so harassed with the nightmare of consequences, he dreaded so much the immediate issues before him, that seeing while he breakfasted the arrival of the Riverston coach, he went out hurriedly and took his place on it, that he might be relieved at least for a day from the necessity of doing or saying anything in Middlemarch. Will Ladislaw was in one of those tangled crises which are commoner in experience than one might imagine, from the shallow absoluteness of men's judgments. He had found Lydgate, for whom he had the sincerest respect, under circumstances which claimed his thorough and frankly declared sympathy. And the reason why, in spite of that claim, it would have been better for Will to have avoided all further intimacy or even contact with Lydgate, was precisely of the kind to make such a course appear impossible. To a creature of Will's susceptible temperament, without any neutral region of indifference in his nature, ready to turn everything that befell him into the collisions of a passionate drama, the revelation that Rosamond had made her happiness in any way dependent on him was a difficulty which his outburst of rage towards her had immeasurably increased for him. He hated his own cruelty, and yet he dreaded to show the fullness of his relenting. He must go to her again. The friendship could not be put to a sudden end, and her unhappiness was a power which he dreaded. And all the while, there was no more foretaste of enjoyment in the life before him than if his limbs had been lopped off and he was making his fresh start on crutches. In the night, he had debated whether he should not get on the coach not for Riverston but for London, leaving a note to Lydgate which would give a makeshift reason for his retreat. But there were strong cords pulling him back from that abrupt departure. The blight on his happiness in thinking of Dorothea, the crushing of that chief hope which had remained in spite of the acknowledged necessity for renunciation, was too fresh a misery for him to resign himself to it and go straightway into a distance which was also despair. Thus he did nothing more decided than take the Riverston coach. He came back again by it while it was still daylight, having made up his mind that he must go to Lydgate's that evening. The Rubicon, we know, was a very insignificant stream to look at. Its significance lay entirely in certain invisible conditions. Will felt as if he were forced to cross his small boundary ditch, and what he saw beyond it was not empire, but discontented subjection. But it is given to us sometimes, even in our everyday life, to witness the saving influence of a noble nature, the divine efficacy of rescue that may lie in a self-subduing act of fellowship. If Dorothea, after her night's anguish, had not taken that walk to Rosamond, why, she perhaps would have been a woman who gained a higher character for discretion.
but it would certainly not have been as well for those three who were on one hearth in Lydgate's house at 7:30 that evening. Rosamond had been prepared for Will's visit, and she received him with a languid coldness, which Lydgate accounted for by her nervous exhaustion, of which he could not suppose that it had any relation to Will. And when she sat in silence, bending over a bit of work, he innocently apologised for her in an indirect way by begging her to lean backward and rest. Will was miserable in the necessity for playing the part of a friend who was making his first appearance and greeting to Rosamond, while his thoughts were busy about her feelings since that scene of yesterday, which seemed still inexorably to enclose them both like the painful vision of a double madness. It happened that nothing called Lydgate out of the room, but when Rosamond poured out the tea and Will came near to fetch it, she placed a tiny bit of folded paper in his saucer. He saw it and secured it quickly. But as he went back to his inn, he had no eagerness to unfold the paper. What Rosamond had written to him would probably deepen the painful impressions of the evening. Still, he opened and read it by his bed candle. There were only these few words in her neatly flowing hand. "I have told Mrs. Casaubon. She is not under any mistake about you. I told her because she came to see me and was very kind. You will have nothing to reproach me with now. I shall not have made any difference to you." The effect of these words was not quite all gladness. As Will dwelt on them with excited imagination, he felt his cheeks and ears burning at the thought of what had occurred between Dorothea and Rosamond, at the uncertainty how far Dorothea might still feel her dignity wounded in having an explanation of his conduct offered to her. There might still remain in her mind a changed association with him which made an irremediable difference, a lasting flaw. With active fancy, he wrought himself into a state of doubt, little more easy than that of the man who has escaped from wreck by night and stands on unknown ground in the darkness. Until that wretched yesterday, except the moment of vexation long ago in the very same room and in the very same presence, all their vision, all their thought of each other, had been as in a world apart, where the sunshine fell on tall white lilies, where no evil lurked and no other soul entered. But now, would Dorothea meet him in that world again? Chapter 83. On the second morning after Dorothea's visit to Rosamond, she had had two nights of sound sleep, and had not only lost all trace of fatigue, but felt as if she had a great deal of superfluous strength, that is to say, more strength than she could manage to concentrate on any occupation. The day before, she had taken long walks outside the grounds and had paid two visits to the parsonage, but she never in her life told anyone the reason why she spent her time in that fruitless manner, and this morning she was rather angry with herself for her childish restlessness. Today was to be spent quite differently. What was there to be done in the village? Oh, dear, nothing. Everybody was well and had flannel, nobody's pig had died, and it was Saturday morning when there was a general scrubbing of floors and doorstones, and when it was useless to go into the school. But there were various subjects that Dorothea was trying to get clear upon, and she resolved to throw herself energetically into the gravest of all. She sat down in the library before her particular little heap of books on political economy and kindred matters, out of which she was trying to get light as to the best way of spending money so as not to injure one's neighbours, or, what comes to the same thing, so as to do them the most good. Here was a weighty subject, which, if she could but lay hold of it, would certainly keep her mind steady. Unhappily, her mind slipped off it for a whole hour, and at the end she found herself reading sentences twice over, with an intense consciousness of many things, but not of any one thing contained in the text. This was hopeless. Should she order the carriage and drive to Tipton? No, for some reason or other she preferred staying at Lowick. But her vagrant mind must be reduced to order. There was an art in self-discipline, and she walked round and round the brown library considering by what sort of manoeuvre she could arrest her wandering thoughts. Perhaps a mere task was the best means, something to which she must go doggedly. Was there not the geography of Asia Minor, in which her slackness had often been rebuked by Mr. Casaubon?
she went to the cabinet of maps and unrolled one. This morning she might make herself finally sure that Paphlagonia was not on the Levantine coast, and fix her total darkness about the Chalybes firmly on the shores of the Euxine. A map was a fine thing to study when you were disposed to think of something else, being made up of names that would turn into a chime if you went back upon them. Dorothea set earnestly to work, bending close to her map and uttering the names in an audible, subdued tone which often got into a chime. She looked amusingly girlish after all her deep experience, nodding her head and marking the names off on her fingers with a little pursing of her lip, and now and then breaking off to put her hands on each side of her face and say, "Oh, dear, oh, dear." There was no reason why this should end, any more than a merry-go-round, but it was at last interrupted by the opening of the door and the announcement of Miss Noble. The little old lady, whose bonnet hardly reached Dorothea's shoulder, was warmly welcomed, but while her hand was being pressed, she made many of her beaver-like noises, as if she had something difficult to say. "Do sit down," said Dorothea, rolling a chair forward. "Am I wanted for anything? I shall be so glad if I can do anything."
"I will not stay,"
said Miss Noble, putting her hand into her small basket and holding some article inside it nervously.
"I have left a friend in the churchyard."
She lapsed into her inarticulate sounds, and unconsciously drew forth the article which she was fingering. It was the tortoiseshell lozenge box, and Dorothea felt the colour mounting to her cheeks.
"Mr. Ladislaw," continued the timid little woman, "he fears he has offended you, and has begged me to ask if you will see him for a few minutes."
Dorothea did not answer on the instant. It was crossing her mind that she could not receive him in this library where her husband's prohibition seemed to dwell. She looked towards the window. Could she go out and meet him in the grounds? The sky was heavy and the trees had begun to shiver as at a coming storm. Besides, she shrank from going out to him.
"Do see him, Mrs. Casaubon,"
said Miss Noble pathetically.
"Else I must go back and say no, and that will hurt him."
"Yes, I will see him," said Dorothea. "Pray tell him to come."
What else was there to be done? There was nothing that she longed for at the moment except to see Will. The possibility of seeing him had thrust itself insistently between her and every other object. And yet she had a throbbing excitement like an alarm upon her, a sense that she was doing something daringly defiant for his sake. When the little lady had trotted away on her mission, Dorothea stood in the middle of the library with her hands falling clasped before her, making no attempt to compose herself in an attitude of dignified unconsciousness. What she was least conscious of just then was her own body. She was thinking of what was likely to be in Will's mind, and of the hard feelings that others had had about him. How could any duty bind her to hardness? Resistance to unjust dispraise had mingled with her feeling for him from the very first. And now, in the rebound of her heart after her anguish, the resistance was stronger than ever. "If I love him too much, it is because he has been used so ill." There was a voice within her saying this to some imagined audience in the library, when the door was opened and she saw Will before her. She did not move, and he came towards her with more doubt and timidity in his face than she had ever seen before. He was in a state of uncertainty, which made him afraid lest some look or word of his should condemn him to a new distance from her. And Dorothea was afraid of her own emotion. She looked as if there were a spell upon her, keeping her motionless and hindering her from unclasping her hands, while some intense, grave yearning was imprisoned within her eyes. Seeing that she did not put out her hand as usual, Will paused a yard from her and said with embarrassment, "I am so grateful to you for seeing me."
"I wanted to see you,"
said Dorothea, having no other words at command. It did not occur to her to sit down, and Will did not give a cheerful interpretation to this queenly way of receiving him, but he went on to say what he had made up his mind to say. "I fear you think me foolish and perhaps wrong for coming back so soon.
I have been punished for my impatience. You know, everyone knows now, a painful story about my parentage. I knew of it before I went away, and I always meant to tell you of it if we ever met again.
There was a slight movement in Dorothea, and she unclasped her hands, but immediately folded them over each other.
"But the affair is matter of gossip now," Will continued. "I wished you to know that something connected with it, something which happened before I went away, helped to bring me down here again. At least, I thought it excused my coming. It was the idea of getting Bulstrode to apply some money to a public purpose, some money which he had thought of giving me. Perhaps it is rather to Bulstrode's credit that he privately offered me compensation for an old injury. He offered to give me a good income to make amends. But I suppose you know the disagreeable story."
Will looked doubtfully at Dorothea, but his manner was gathering some of the defiant courage with which he always thought of this fact in his destiny. He added,
"You know that it must be altogether painful to me."
"Yes, yes, I know," said Dorothea hastily.
"I did not choose to accept an income from such a source. I was sure that you would not think well of me if I did so," said Will.
Why should he mind saying anything of that sort to her now? She knew that he had avowed his love for her.
"I felt that..."
He broke off, nevertheless.
"You acted as I should have expected you to act," said Dorothea, her face brightening, and her head becoming a little more erect on its beautiful stem.
"I did not believe that you would let any circumstance of my birth create a prejudice in you against me, though it was sure to do so in others," said Will, shaking his head backward in his old way, and looking with a grave appeal into her eyes.
"If it were a new hardship, it would be a new reason for me to cling to you," said Dorothea fervidly. "Nothing could have changed me but..."
Her heart was swelling, and it was difficult to go on. She made a great effort over herself to say in a low, tremulous voice,
"But thinking that you were different, not so good as I had believed you to be."
"You are sure to believe me better than I am in everything but one," said Will, giving way to his own feeling in the evidence of hers. "I mean in my truth to you. When I thought you doubted of that, I didn't care about anything that was left. I thought it was all over with me, and there was nothing to try for, only things to endure."
"I don't doubt you any longer," said Dorothea, putting out her hand, a vague fear for him impelling her unutterable affection.
He took her hand and raised it to his lips with something like a sob. But he stood with his hat and gloves in the other hand and might have done for the portrait of a royalist. Still, it was difficult to loose the hand, and Dorothea, withdrawing it in a confusion that distressed her, looked and moved away.
"See how dark the clouds have become, and how the trees are tossed," she said, walking towards the window, yet speaking and moving with only a dim sense of what she was doing.
Will followed her at a little distance and leaned against the tall back of a leather chair, on which he ventured now to lay his hat and gloves and free himself from the intolerable durance of formality to which he had been for the first time condemned in Dorothea's presence. It must be confessed that he felt very happy at that moment leaning on the chair. He was not much afraid of anything that she might feel now. They stood silent, not looking at each other, but looking at the evergreens which were being tossed and were showing the pale underside of their leaves against the blackening sky. Will never enjoyed the prospect of a storm so much. It delivered him from the necessity of going away. Leaves and little branches were hurled about, and the thunder was getting nearer. The light was more and more sombre, but there came a flash of lightning which made them start and look at each other, and then smile. Dorothea began to say what she had been thinking of.
"That was a wrong thing for you to say, that you would have had nothing to try for. If we had lost our own chief good, other people's good would remain, and that is worth trying for. Some can be happy. I seemed to see that more clearly than ever when I was the most wretched. I can hardly think how I could have borne the trouble if that feeling had not come to me to make strength.
"You have never felt the sort of misery I felt," said Will. "The misery of knowing that you must despise me."
"But I have felt worse. It was worse to think ill."
Dorothea had begun impetuously, but broke off.
Will coloured. He had the sense that whatever she said was uttered in the vision of a fatality that kept them apart. He was silent a moment, and then said passionately, "We may at least have the comfort of speaking to each other without disguise. Since I must go away, since we must always be divided, you may think of me as one on the brink of the grave."
While he was speaking, there came a vivid flash of lightning which lit each of them up for the other, and the light seemed to be the terror of a hopeless love. Dorothea darted instantaneously from the window. Will followed her, seizing her hand with a spasmodic movement. And so they stood, with their hands clasped, like two children, looking out on the storm, while the thunder gave a tremendous crack and roll above them, and the rain began to pour down. Then they turned their faces towards each other, with the memory of his last words in them, and they did not loose each other's hands. "There is no hope for me," said Will. "Even if you loved me as well as I love you, even if I were everything to you, I shall most likely always be very poor. On a sober calculation, one can count on nothing but a creeping lot. It is impossible for us ever to belong to each other. It is perhaps base of me to have asked for a word from you. I meant to go away into silence, but I have not been able to do what I meant."
"Don't be sorry," said Dorothea in her clear, tender tones. "I would rather share all the trouble of our parting."
Her lips trembled, and so did his. It was never known which lips were the first to move towards the other lips. But they kissed tremblingly, and then they moved apart. The rain was dashing against the window panes as if an angry spirit were within it, and behind it was the great swoop of the wind. It was one of those moments in which both the busy and the idle pause with a certain awe. Dorothea sat down on the seat nearest to her, a long, low ottoman in the middle of the room, and with her hands folded over each other on her lap, looked at the drear outer world. Will stood still an instant looking at her, then seated himself beside her and laid his hand on hers, which turned itself upward to be clasped. They sat in that way without looking at each other, until the rain abated and began to fall in stillness. Each had been full of thoughts which neither of them could begin to utter. But when the rain was quiet, Dorothea turned to look at Will. With passionate exclamation, as if some torture screw were threatening him, he started up and said, "It is impossible!" He went and leaned on the back of the chair again, and seemed to be battling with his own anger, while she looked towards him sadly. "It is as fatal as a murder or any other horror that divides people," he burst out again. "It is more intolerable to have our life maimed by petty accidents."
"No, don't say that. Your life need not be maimed," said Dorothea gently.
"Yes, it must," said Will angrily. "It is cruel of you to speak in that way, as if there were any comfort. You may see beyond the misery of it, but I don't. It is unkind. It is throwing back my love for you as if it were a trifle to speak in that way in the face of the fact. We shall never be married."
"Sometime we might," said Dorothea in a trembling voice.
"When?" said Will bitterly. "What is the use of counting on any success of mine? It is a mere toss-up whether I shall ever do more than keep myself decently, unless I choose to sell myself as a mere pen and a mouthpiece. I can see that clearly enough. I could not offer myself to any woman, even if she had no luxuries to renounce."
There was silence. Dorothea's heart was full of something that she wanted to say, and yet the words were too difficult. She was wholly possessed by them. At that moment, debate was mute within her.
and it was very hard that she could not say what she wanted to say. Will was looking out of the window angrily. If he would have looked at her and not gone away from her side, she thought everything would have been easier. At last he turned, still resting against the chair, and stretching his hand automatically towards his hat, said with a sort of exasperation, "Goodbye."
"Oh, I cannot bear it. My heart will break," said Dorothea, starting from her seat, the flood of her young passion bearing down all the obstructions which had kept her silent, the great tears rising and falling in an instant. "I don't mind about poverty. I hate my wealth."
In an instant Will was close to her and had his arms round her. But she drew her head back and held his away gently, that she might go on speaking, her large tear-filled eyes looking at his very simply, while she said in a sobbing, childlike way,
"We could live quite well on my own fortune. It is too much, 700 a year. I want so little, no new clothes, and I will learn what everything costs."
End of disc 25.